It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. This just in, we know what Jay Powell is thinking. It did take him a whole lot more than five words, though. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 17th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So the way it works, on the days the Fed wraps up its big meetings, is that Chair Jay Powell comes out. He reads the official statement, what the Fed is thinking about the overall economy since its last meeting, where the economy might be going, and where interest rates might be headed. And then he opens it up for questions. Business and economic reporters, being a detail-oriented bunch, can get kind of weedy in those questions, which, lucky for you, is where we come in. There were, when all was said and done, two, count them, two messages that Powell wanted to make sure everybody got out of today's back and forth. Message one, all the talk about inflation. I'm paraphrasing here, but basically he said, come on, cut it out.
Talking about inflation is one thing. Actually having inflation run above 2% is the real thing.
No, seriously, cut it out.
You know, over the years, we've talked about 2% inflation as a goal, but we haven't achieved it. So I would say we'd like to, you know, perform. That's what we'd really like to do, is to get inflation moderately above 2%.
Again, I was paraphrasing. Message number two, where the Fed thinks this economy might be going.
The state of the economy in 2 or 3 years is highly uncertain.
So there you go, Jay Powell and what he's thinking in, okay, yeah, fine. It was 70 words, I counted. Among the couple thousand other words that Powell spoke today, some number of them were about jobs and unemployment and how it's going to be a while before the labor market is back to something near normal. But there is something weird going on out there, because there are about 10 million people out of work in this economy, but businesses are saying they're having a hard time finding people to hire. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore tries to make sense of that one.
The National Federation of Independent Business reported that 40% of its small business members had job openings they could not fill.
It varies a lot by industry.
Bill Dunkelberg is chief economist at the NFIB.
For example, the highest would be in construction, manufacturing, transportation.
There are different theories for how this is possible with 10 million people looking for jobs.
One of the problems, of course, is that it pays you pretty well to be on unemployment these days.
Unemployment benefits are too high, says Dunkelberg. It's a contentious claim. Catherine Abraham, professor of economics at the University of Maryland, says her reading of the research is that it's unlikely.
If you're an unemployed worker, you know, looking for a job, you know that the unemployment benefits aren't going to last forever. So if you're offered a job that's attractive, it makes sense for you to take it.
Robert Frick, corporate economist with the Navy Federal Credit Union, has another explanation for the apparent worker shortage.
There are few qualified applicants for the jobs that are open. So there's obviously a skills mismatch.
The unemployed waiters are probably not going to be applying for the manufacturing or the tech jobs. Professor Abraham suspects there is an altogether different explanation for this whole situation.
If they paid more, they could attract more people.
According to the NFIB, 25% of businesses say they have raised pay, and another 19% plan to. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Inflation, of which Chair Powell is speaking today, can be kind of a hit or miss thing. No rising prices in one part of the economy, big increases in another, including prices, in our case, for a product we don't think about all that much, most of us, shipping containers. Yeah, those 20 or 40 foot long boxes inside of which the new fridge you ordered is coming, or the fancy cheeses you're going to buy at the store, or the spare parts. Consumer demand here and elsewhere is gumming up the global economy, and there just aren't enough empty containers in, say, China to send stuff across the Pacific. So shipping companies and importers are scrambling to get their hands on whatever they can at whatever price. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Services, services. We've been telling you ad nauseum that Americans buy more services than goods. But these days, not so much, says Simon Heaney at the shipping consultancy Drewry.
People aren't able to spend on going out, holidays, etc. So they put what they have into physical goods that are generally shipped in containers.
Clogged U.S. ports don't have enough cranes or workers to handle everything, and these traffic jams are creating a shortage in China, where almost all containers are made. Florian Frese is with the logistics firm Container Exchange.
Obviously, right now, a golden time for Chinese container manufacturers because they produce as much as possible and can basically charge whatever price they want.
He says normally, a new 20-foot container costs $2,000, but that's nearly doubled. Chinese exporters are also paying top dollar to bring empty containers from North America, says Steve Kranig at the transport firm IMEX Global.
There was a report I read this morning from a very knowledgeable source that 70% of vessels departing over the last 2 months out of Long Beach were filled entirely with empty containers.
All these hassles have raised shipping prices, causing a few toy factories in Asia to stop deliveries, and some food and grain firms to use bulk ships with loose piles of cargo. Picking outside the, box, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
That was pretty good, outside the box. A vanishingly rare moment of bipartisanship in the United States Senate today. Katherine Tai was approved 98-0 as the U.S. Trade Representative, first woman of color to have that job, and the first Asian American in the president's cabinet, which does seem worth remarking on given the news out of Atlanta last night. On Wall Street today, traders liked what Jay Powell said. Well enough. Not wild, but whatever. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is going to sound a little bit counterintuitive, kind of like that hard-to-find workers paradox that Sabri was talking about. But 2020 was a big year for entrepreneurship. Applications to start new businesses were 24% higher last year than they were in 2019. Ashley Nelson, one of the 10 people we've been following in our series about the American labor force called The United States of Work, is now an independent hairstylist in Boise, Idaho. She used to work in a salon but struck out on her own with the pandemic's arrival. So, almost a year since she left that salon for good, we have gotten her back on the phone. Ashley, it's good to have you on again.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
It's been a while, almost a year, I think. And last time we spoke, I think you were getting ready to shut things down at the salon and go out on your own. How have things been this past year?
Things have been good. Things have been very hectic. My eyes have been opened up to a whole new world of business owning. Got a whole nother level of respect for it now. It's well, never ending.
Well, so tell me about that. I mean, obviously you had to probably rent some kind of space. You have to do your own equipment. I mean, all of that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the expenses in the beginning is a big startup, which, is really exciting. I almost have that all paid for and taken care of. So that is really good for being that it's only been a year. But yeah, the job never stops. I mean, from continuing education to being in contact with the clients till doing laundry until the hours of the night when you get home from work. So yeah, it's just never ending.
I want to back you up for a minute and you saying that you had just finished or almost finished paying off the startup process. How much, if I might, did it cost you to start up?
It was around $20,000 with like all of the things that it got done to the suite that I was in. with product and everything like that.
That's not nothing.
No, it wasn't. It was definitely a big chunk of change, and I've never had credit cards until I had to get this. So yeah, wow. I'm excited to have it taken care of and handled.
I'm sure you are. Now let's talk the revenue side of this business. How's your client base? Is it, did you bring people with you? Did they follow? Are you growing? What's going on there?
Yes. Most of my clientele did follow. A few did not. You know, I have gained clients that are more downtown, especially mm-hmm. with businesses starting to open back up downtown.
Yeah.
I'm always like thinking ahead a little bit. So I'm trying to just kind of soak in the situation and then hopefully take the next step forward, which would be like opening up my own salon to create a space for more people to come grow with me.
That'd be exciting. When do you think you might be able to do that? That'd be a big step.
Yeah. You know, I'm not one to take on a bunch of debt. So I'm definitely taking one step at a time, trying to put my feelers out there. I mean, I'm looking at spaces on a regular basis, but it takes a lot to open up a salon. You know, I mean, now that I know how much 150 square foot space costs at my taste, I know how much it will be if I have 10 girls in the space. So right. I think that makes a difference.
Right. So we've been doing some work with other micro business owners, really tiny, small businesses, you know, 2-3 employees up to maybe 20. And I guess with your newfound appreciation for running a small business, what do you want people to know about it as you try to, you know, get by in this pandemic?
Buy local, get off Amazon. I hate to say that, but I don't think people realize how much it takes just for somebody to even open up a business. I think it's definitely the easier route is to go work for somebody else. So mad respect to everyone who takes that risk on themselves.
Ashley Nelson, she is an independent hairstylist up in Boise, Idaho, one of the 10 people we're following for our series about the American labor force. Ashley, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
We've all been doing a lot of waiting in this pandemic, mostly because we've had no choice, waiting for COVID tests, waiting for the vaccine, waiting, honestly, for this whole horrible thing to be over with. Businesses have been waiting, too, for us to come back. And now, slowly, the waiting game feels like it might be headed toward some kind of finish line. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
I'm in Brooklyn outside of one of the hottest places to be these days. Whenever I walk by, no matter what time of day, people are waiting to get inside. Today, Lakin Starling is one of them.
It could be a Tuesday morning and there's a long line. Like, it really, unless like Beyonce is inside, like I'm typically not waiting in line.
But no, Starling isn't in line for a superstar. She's in line for a supermarket, Trader Joe's.
It's a mental like exercise for me to get up and come and like get groceries because of the line. But yeah, I think just having to surrender to the fact that like none of this is in our control and having to be patient about those things.
But patience can be a funny thing. Ayelet at Fishback teaches behavior science and marketing at the University of Chicago.
Expectation matters a lot. When we think that something is almost over, we become extremely impatient. Now, the surprising effect is that as things become nearer, it is harder to wait for them.
And despite all the practice we've had, when we finally are done waiting and the world reopens, we might find that we're not any better at it.
We don't find that patience in one context is necessarily related to patience in another context.
And Fishback says we've become used to certain things being less of a hassle. Traffic is lighter. Almost anything can be delivered with one click. There are open tables at restaurants, even on a Friday night.
Certain conveniences are going to stick with us. We were spoiled in a way.
If economists are right and people want to make up for lost time, things could get inconvenient fast. There will be waits for a treadmill at the gym, for tickets to a hit movie, for that restaurant table on a Friday night. Jamal Pender researches queuing theory at Cornell University. He says companies should be thinking about how they're going to deal with lines now.
It's hard to say like all these small businesses, you know, they should have visionaries, et cetera. But you do need to sort of look ahead and see what is the landscape. How are things kind of moving?
because a lot of money could be left on the table if businesses aren't prepared.
There's a phenomenon that I also studied called abandonment. How patient are customers? And there's a lot of different features on why a customer may stay, they may go.
What's the weather like? Are they with kids or friends? How much do they value the thing they're waiting for? How much do they value their own time? Businesses have ways to make people feel like they're not waiting as long, playing music and offering customers a seat at the bar until their table is ready. One of the best ways to cut down on waiting is to just offer more of whatever you sell. That's what Steve Wong is planning at Oxalis, the restaurant he co-owns in Brooklyn.
Candidly speaking, you know, the most difficult times are likely behind us.
When I first met Wong in August, his team was trying to turn an overgrown parking lot behind the restaurant into a space worthy of its Michelin star. Back then, he planned to ditch outdoor dining once life returned to something like normal. Now,
we feel pretty good that there's going to be somewhat of a kind of boom coming our way and getting to reap some of the benefits of having, you know, all the pent-up demands.
Come summer, he expects the restaurant to book a month out, just like old times. So he's upgraded the new outdoor space, is planning to expand hours, and is looking for a spot to open a sister restaurant. Because you know what they say, even if we haven't heard it in a while. Time is money. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I'm not getting anything. There were no nibbles.
Maybe time to cast a wider net, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 189 today, 0.5%, 33,015 to be exact. First time over 33K ever. NASDAQ picked up 53 points, 0.4%, 13,525. The S&P 500 added 11 points, 0.2%, 39.74. Disney's CEO told CNBC today that its California theme parks, Disneyland and California Adventure, California Adventure is better, by the way, going to reopen April 30th with attendance restrictions, mask requirements, and the like. Shutdowns forced Disney to lay off tens of thousands of workers early in this thing. Disney up 0.5% on Wall Street today. Bonds down, yields up 1.64% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Now, news of online dating. Match Group, which owns OkCupid, Our Time, Plenty of Fish, Match.com, and Tinder, said this week it's going to partner with a nonprofit called Garbo to eventually let users do criminal background checks on potential dates. There's going to be a pilot on Tinder later this year, obviously to uncover histories of violence or abuse. But perhaps just as obviously, there are some privacy concerns here. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
This move is all about safety, according to Garbo founder Catherine Kosmidis. The idea is that before you go on a date, as long as you have a first name and a phone number,
you'll see someone's arrest data, conviction history, orders of protection, all public records and reports, especially around the reporting of violence.
But with all that data just a few clicks away from a dating profile, some privacy experts are concerned about accuracy. Michelle Richardson is with the Center for Democracy and Technology.
Yeah, it's really an admirable goal. The question is, are things like criminal records a good proxy for whether someone's violent? And the problem is that they are not.
A lot of intimate partner violence never gets reported in the first place. Plus, there's a lot of discrimination in the criminal justice system. Garbo founder Kosmidis says the platform will leave out low-level traffic violations and minor drug crimes, but says Karen Levy, who teaches information science at Cornell,
you know, arrests are racially disproportionate for all kinds of crimes, right? Not just drug crime.
Levy says it's easy to understand wanting to know whether a potential date has a history of violence. What's harder is determining where one person's right to safety infringes on another person's right to privacy. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Hey, you need something to read? Might I suggest our Make Me Smart newsletter named, yes, after the podcast Molly and I do. This week, virtual events. It seems they might outlast the pandemic, which seems suboptimal. Subscribe at marketplace.org/newsletters. Today's Marketplace quiz is in the corporate mix and match category. What do these five companies, Twitter, Yelp, Salesforce, Levi's, and The Gap, have in common? If you guessed they are all based in San Francisco, sadly, only half credit. They are all San Francisco companies, yes, but they are San Francisco companies that are giving up a chunk of their offices. In all, millions of square feet of cubicles and conference rooms that have been flooding the sublease market in San Francisco. That's office space that used to be among the most expensive in the country. And right now, the city by the bay is the emptiest and cheapest it's been in decades, which means somebody's got to be thinking about moving in, right? Marketplace's Matt Levin has that story.
You know when you're in the checkout line at Target and you see that Must Love Dogs DVD on clearance for like $2.99 and you wonder, why in the world is Target still selling DVDs? Stephen McDonald is starting to feel like that Target. But instead of John Cusack rom-coms, he's trying to unload office space in San Francisco.
So this one, the lady's gone. I'm probably paying $12.50 for this. And so I'm going to discount it for you.
McDonald's in his 70s. He's been practicing real estate law for over 30 years. Most of that time he's been here in the Flood Building, which used to be a primo location. A few blocks from Union Square in the Financial District, right off the subway. He's showing me one of the two small offices he's trying to sublet.
Do I get the furniture?
Yes.
Is this mahogany? What is
No, this is cheap Office Depot stuff.
In my defense, I've been working out of my living room for over a year. Anything that isn't IKEA furniture looks pretty elegant. McDonald's offices have been on the market since last fall, when the other lawyers at his firm said they plan to join the hybrid revolution, some days at work, some at home. The problem is every other San Francisco lawyer or therapist or insurance agent has the same idea. With 2 years left on the lease, how low is McDonald willing to go?
Between you and me, 500, because I'm not getting anything. And I just spoke to my administrator to try to remember the room number, and she tells me they dropped the ad. There were no nibbles.
That's probably because about 20% of San Francisco office space is on the market right now, nearly 14 million square feet of emptiness. Robert Sammons is head of West Coast research for the commercial real estate company Cushman & Wakefield. We're outside the Salesforce Tower, the city's tallest building and a gleaming monument to just how much property big tech has devoured over the past decade.
It does hover over you, doesn't it?
Salmon says demand for trophy buildings like this one is holding up pretty well. Nothing says our SPAC killed its IPO like a view of the Golden Gate Bridge from the 61st floor.
If you are a top-tier tenant, if you want to be in the best product in San Francisco, you would look to Salesforce Tower.
But lesser buildings without a commute by gondola option, they're cheaper now. Salmon says that could be an opportunity for the next Salesforce, which right now could be just two coders working out of the proverbial garage.
There are smaller tech companies, there are smaller professional services firms. Now is kind of the time, the sweet spot for a lot of those companies.
So far, startups are doing more window shopping than actual leasing. A different industry is being far more aggressive scooping up space. They're still tech-ish, just not hoodie tech-ish.
If you walk through the lab, you'd see a typical diagnostic lab. And yes, there's lab coats.
Ken Knight is chief operating officer at Invitae, a biotech firm that does DNA testing. Earlier this month, it inked a deal for a second San Francisco location.
We wouldn't have signed the lease if we didn't feel good about the opportunity and what was presented to us. So yeah, we feel good about the deal.
Biotech companies can't go fully remote, and that's been a lifeline for San Francisco real estate. 3 months earlier, drug company Vir Biotechnologies took over Dropbox's headquarters. Not long after, the property sold for over $1 billion. That's a record price per square foot for San Francisco office space. And a strong signal that investors don't think the city is going to ghost itself. Real estate lawyer Stephen McDonald isn't going anywhere. Nibbles or no nibbles, he's made this place his own.
This is a room that, to use the vernacular, I pimped up.
Right before the pandemic, McDonald was putting the finishing touches on what he calls his 18th century lounge. Leather couches, a tapestry from the Austro-Hungarian Empire on one wall, an oil painting of some random French aristocrat he doesn't know on the other.
I was just about to hang this chandelier, 18th century French lantern.
And it's still in the box.
It's still in the box.
McDonald knows other San Francisco law firms are going remote, but he thinks he has a competitive advantage staying put. even if he can't sublease his extra space, maybe one of his lawyers needs a place to store their DVDs. In San Francisco, I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which the Internal Revenue Service says, yeah, no, we got too much going on, and so do you. For the second year in a row, thanks, coronavirus. Tax day is being pushed back. May 17th is the new deadline. That's a Monday, so yeah, kiss that weekend before. Goodbye, I guess. All right, we got to go, but here's your moment of economic context. Tip of the hat to Scott Tong, who keeps an eye on the global energy beat for us. He brought this up in our meeting this morning, a report from the International Energy Agency that says, among a whole bunch of other things, as those reports always do, that we may well have already hit peak demand for gasoline. Here's a relevant sentence. Gasoline demand is unlikely to return to 2019 levels, the report says, as efficiency gains... That's gas mileage, right? As efficiency gains and the shift to electric vehicles eclipse robust mobility growth in the developing world, which is kind of wild. Also, they say elsewhere in this thing, changes in work and commuting patterns because of the pandemic are obviously factors as well. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostat, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Liana Squillaci, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They are, of course, the ones coming into the studio, so the rest of us don't have to, unless home internet, blah, blah, blah. You guys have heard that. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.